And let's open our Bible to Romans chapter 7. Romans chapter 7. I have two titles for my message this morning, and I can't choose which one to use, and so I'll give them both to you, and then you'll know where we're going. The first title is The Message for the Gentile. And the other title is Discipling Begins at Evangelism. So that's what we'll be talking about. And maybe after we're all through, you can decide which title would be the best one and let me know. In Romans 7, Paul takes off in the first few verses with an analogy that he uses to establish a principle. You know, this thing is humming a little bit, and who is working on this? Microphone? How do you turn the volume down? I'm an unemployed artist, not an unemployed engineer, you notice. Okay, we'll try that. That's better. He starts out and he says, "Do you not know, brethren, for I am speaking to those who know the law, that the law is binding on a person only during his life? Thus, a married woman is bound by law to her husband as long as he lives. But if her husband dies, she is discharged from the law concerning her husband. Accordingly, she will be called an adulteress if she lives with another man while her husband is alive. But if her husband dies, she is free from that law. And if she marries another man, she is not an adulteress." And so in this analogy, we have a husband and a wife. And the law says that as long as the husband is alive, the wife is not free to leave him and marry someone else. And then in the next verses, he applies this analogy to us. Now, in this analogy, who is the wife and who is the husband? Let's read on and see. "Likewise, my brethren, you have died to the law through the body of Christ, so that you may belong to another, to him who has been raised from the dead, in order that we may bear fruit for God." Well, as you examine the passage, you will see that the husband in this case is the law, and the wife in this case is us. Now, it's not a very happy marriage, because the husband is too perfect. That's usually why marriages aren't very happy. But the law is perfect, and we, as the wife, well, we're just sort of sloppy. And the husband, he wants everything just so. His breakfast has to be served at a certain time. The coffee has to be a certain temperature,
right.
And the house has to be spotless and in order. And the wife, when she gets up, she has to appear as she just stepped out, as if she just had stepped out of Vogue magazine, and so on and so on and so on. Well, the wife, she loves to sleep in until 11 o'clock, go around in an old kimono, and get up and open a can of soup and not even bother to heat it and sit and watch television all day. Well, so the husband comes home from work and finds this mess and that creature that he's married to, and he just can't take it. Now, the wife is not very happy either, because she knows that she's not pleasing him, and she gets tired of the pressure, you know, on her, and so it's a very unhappy marriage. And to make matters worse, as we look at this passage, we find that another man comes into the picture who is also just as perfect. And he says, "If you could only be free of that husband of yours, we could get married." And, of course, my standards are just as high, but I have something here that will change you, and you will be able to meet my standards as if it were the most natural thing in the world. Oh, the wife would really love to leave that husband and marry the other. But you know the law. As long as the husband is alive, you can't leave him. So what happens? Well, we find a Brazilian solution. We always have a jeito, you know, just kind of a way out when nothing else works. The wife dies. And comes back to life and is free to marry the new man. Now that's exactly what happens at salvation, isn't it? We die, we are freed from the law, and now we are free to be married to Christ. Now the fruit of the first marriage was what? Verse 5, death. The fruit of the second marriage is what? Well, it just says fruit, doesn't it? Now, I've pondered that word fruit for a long time, wondering whether it means Galatians 5, 22 and 23, or John 15, 16. Well, I think that it means John 15, 16. I'll tell you why. I've observed in the lives of men as they mature in their relationship with Christ an unquenchable desire to bring other people to maturity in Christ. And men are frustrated the more they grow and the more they mature, the more they are frustrated if they do not succeed in not just getting decisions, but in producing children who come to maturity. And the natural result, the natural result of our marriage to Christ is spiritual children who go on to maturity. About a month ago, I was meeting with Jack Ament and four of his henchmen who run the ministry in the town of Novo Hamburgo. That's new hamburger to you people. And we were trying to plan for 1970. And so I was trying to help them think. And so the first question I asked them was, what did you accomplish in 1969? Well, Jack Ament, some of you fellows know Jack, was in the States during that year. And these four men had the responsibility to maintain a movement that involves about 500 new Christians, all of whom are in cell Bible study groups. There are about 40 men and women who are leading these cell groups. And they were on their own, kind of the first time that had happened. And they were content that they had succeeded in holding together and providing nourishment for these 500 people on this level of cell group ministry. And then I said, well, what else did you do? And they almost forgot to tell me. And he says, oh, yes. And one fellow, Edgar, piped up and he said, well, there was this one fellow, Raul. Now, Raul was a fellow that had received 1 year's help from Edgar. He's just kind of a plain guy, kind of a paunch. He had smallpox when he was a kid, it looks like, and sort of a nondescript type person. You'd never pick him out of a crowd. And he's just a new disciple. But he was transferred to a neighboring city. And when he got there, he began to look around for some fellowship, went to the church, and didn't find anything there. As a matter of fact, when Edgar described what it was like there, we all collapsed in laughter because it was really pretty dead. So old Raul looked up Edgar and says, look, would you help me get something started here? Well, to make a long story short, after about 3 months, there were 100 new Christians in the town. And Raul became the consultant for the pastor. And they didn't know what to do with the fruit, and it continued to go on and multiply, and they started two new churches. Well, then it spilled over into the neighboring town, and two new churches were started there. Well, did you know that the Navigators are in the ministry business of building churches? Well, I didn't either. And the great thing about it is that we're not identified with that at all. It just kind of loses, it just kind of goes on out of sight as the generations go on. But the significant thing is that the men even almost forgot to tell me about this. Because it was so natural. Well, I tell you this to show that these four men were at the base of a very exciting thing. People coming to Christ. 500 new Christians studying the Bible. Other towns being affected. And I could go on and on and on. But then I asked them the next question, which was, what was your greatest frustration in 1969? And the first fellow said, I have not succeeded in bringing someone personally to maturity and on into discipleship over the past year. Now, he had gotten some decisions, but he had not been able to follow up on these, nor had he been able to bring anyone on into a discipleship relationship with Christ. The next fellow is a salesman, and he said, I feel like a man who has an excellent product, but for some reason is not able to make the sale. Because he himself had not been able to personally bring his natural contacts to a relationship with Christ in the past year. The next one said, I have been a Christian for several years now, and over the past couple of years, I have not succeeded in bringing someone on to faith in Christ and maturity. And the fourth one said something almost identical. You know, men, you can be involved in a hot ministry. In fact, you can be involved in a disciple-making ministry, and it will wear thin if you are not involved in personally drawing men into a relationship of discipleship with Christ. The mature Christian must have that for his own spiritual health. I'm convinced of that. Getting decisions does not satisfy. Going out in door-to-door evangelism and getting 50 decisions will not satisfy you as much as drawing one man to Christ and beginning to work with him and bringing him onto discipleship. Not to say that the first should not be done. But don't count on that to really satisfy yourself in your own spiritual growth. You need to be a spiritual mother. And a mother just will not be satisfied with running an orphanage. She must be a mother. We have two kids at home. And you know how women are, they always want one more. Well, I'm trying to beat the stork right now. The day before I left, the doctor said, I think I hear more than one in there. Well, I don't have the mother instinct, and that kind of frightens me. Well, my wife would be delighted. And I will too, I guess. I heart on my mother, I guess. So, we need to think, men, in terms of discipleship, discipling. And when do we start thinking that way? At the beginning our evangelism of our evangelism process. I'll never forget when I first arrived in Brazil. It's amazing how starting from scratch clears up your vision. Some of you men know that. And it struck me as to how futile and how foolish it would be for me to go out and get 40 or 50 decisions. I wouldn't even have anybody to report them to. And often, you know, we're motivated by the desire to be able to report something. We think that more is better than few. And so that's not a very noble motive, and it catches up with us. And I realized that if I did not have the men around 5 years later, I might just as well not start with them when you're starting from scratch. What would be the point of evangelizing some people and then have them drift off in a couple of years even and start from scratch all over again? That just didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And so I realized that I needed to rethink this whole business of evangelism. And I reflected back on my experiences here in the States. And I remembered such cases as a sailor that I led to Christ, or that I got a decision from, who, as we met, and as I presented the gospel, it was all go. You know, everything was, boy, this is what I need, this is what I want. Yes, he broke down, sobbed, prayed, and well, I went home happy. You know that I tried for 2 weeks to see him again, and I never got within 100 yards of him. He'd always smell me coming. And I've had a lot of experiences like that. Good, solid decision, apparently. But boy, I could never see the fellows again for smoke. Because something went wrong. That didn't make a whole lot of sense down there in Brazil to try to do that again. So what did we do? Well, the first fellow that I presented the gospel to in the city of Curitiba was a fellow by the name of Osvaldo. I led his brother to Christ while I was in language school, and so of course I looked him up when I got to Curitiba. He was the only contact I had. And so I had him out for dinner, and his brother had written to him about what had happened, and Osvaldo was really curious to know what in the world had happened to Jose, because Jose was not the religious type. So I didn't want to tell him, but little by little he pulled the message out of me, and after a couple of hours there it was, you know, it had the bridge drawn on the floor and everything, and there we were. Well, you know what his response was? He said, you mean that you came all the way down to Brazil just to tell people that? And I said, well, yeah. Well, I don't get the point. What's so important about this? Well, that was sort of deflating. But he did agree to begin to study the scriptures with me. I kind of shamed him into it, and he didn't have much else to do either. And so we began to study the scriptures together. He'd come over for supper two nights a week, and he'd give me about an hour's help on Portuguese, and then at about 8 o'clock we'd swing into the study of the scriptures, and we'd go till midnight. 8 hours a week studying the Bible with Osvaldo. Well, he didn't believe anything. When we started out, he was a free thinker, and he drove me mad, because what we'd do is he'd say, well, now, yeah, but I believe this, and he'd give this big, long, hairy philosophy. So I'd take off and attack it in my faltering Portuguese. And finally, we'd get it nailed down, and I'd say, well, see, it isn't true. And he'd say, well, that's all right. I didn't really believe it anyway. What do you think about this one? Well, this went on for 3.5 months. And finally, Osvaldo came out with it. There was a sin that was hanging him up. He didn't have intellectual problems at all. And he had to admit what that thing was. And it was really tough for him. But then he committed himself to Christ. Right now, he's the man that is going to take over the work in Curitiba next year. Well, I learned something there. Any fathead would, I guess. And the thing that I learned was the thing that Jesus said in John 4:37, where he said, others have labored. Let's see, I can't quote it. Here it is. Here the saying holds true. One sows and another reaps. Verse 38. I sent you to reap that for which you did not labor. Others have labored, and you have entered into their labor. Now he's saying to the apostles here that you men are going to reap. But don't think that it's just you. But others have labored, and you are coming in on the reaping end. When Peter got up and spoke in Acts 2, who was he talking to? Well, I think that a large percentage of them were the people that Jesus talked to as he went from village to village. And Peter entered into the labor of Christ. And without a doubt, every one of them that he talked to were the fruits of the labors of the prophets who preached and suffered and didn't see much result. But there we were in Brazil working with the kind of people who, instead of having a background where the seed had been sown, it had been watered, and it had been cultivated, we found just an empty hole. Well, you do not lead a person to Christ who is in that situation with a 20-minute presentation of the bridge or the four spiritual laws or whatever you have as a presentation. It just takes a lot more than that. We need to plant and water and cultivate and then let God give us the increase. Now, I think that too often we are not sensitive to this in the United States, and I think that when a person kind of flames out after we presented the gospel to him and he's made a decision and he doesn't want to see us again, it's because we did not discern that it was not a reaping situation. Now, that's not easy. Ken Lotus points out that there are three stages in decision making. The first one is the emotional. A person must see his need before he's going to make any kind of a decision. He must see that he has a problem, and that he must have a solution. I think a classic example of this is when Jesus met the lame man at the pool in John. And the lame man had spent 38 years laying by the pool waiting for an improbable cure. Lame from birth. Now remember what Jesus said after he healed him? He said, go and sin no more, lest a worse thing happen to you. Now, why would Jesus say a thing like that? What could be worse than spending 38 years laying by a pool, all crippled up, waiting for something that you knew wasn't going to happen? What could be worse than that? But Jesus said, go and sin no more, lest a worse thing happen to you. And he didn't even explain what that worst thing was. And so here this lame man now walking, walked away, went away with his eyes wide, worried about that worst thing that could happen to him if he sinned. Now let me ask you a question. Can anybody stop sinning? Well, of course not. Well, then why did Jesus tell him to stop sinning if nobody can stop sinning? Well, how do you suppose that lame man felt the first time he caught himself sinning? Here comes that worst thing. He panicked, of course, and he'd see the need. He was emotionally prepared for a decision, I would say, after that. But if we make the decision only on the basis of our emotional response, it will catch up with us. Because the next stage in decision making is the intellect. And a person needs to make a mature decision. He needs enough material, enough information, to see that his decision is rational. And I think that often what has happened with me in the past, and probably will in the future, is that I get a decision from a person who responds emotionally to the message. But the next morning he wakes up and he thinks, what in the world did I do? I really made a fool out of myself. And he's embarrassed about the scene that he made and what happened, mainly because there was no rational content to what he received. Now, it may have been rational to me, but I had the background. But what I would give him would just be the kind of the summaries. And it doesn't make sense to a non-Christian that fast, does it? Well, then the third stage is the will. And you know, man, I have come to the conclusion that that is the only hang-up in coming to Christ, the will. It says, among chief rulers, many believed on him, but they did not confess him. Why? because they love the praise of men more than the praise of God. And Jesus says in John 7, if you will do my will, you will know. Huh? And time after time, in working with men and presenting the gospel to them, the thing that I see is that their intellectual problems die out after a few chapters in the study of John or something. But that doesn't mean that they're ready to receive Christ. It means that the struggle of the will begins. And I have spent 8 months studying with a fellow, waiting for him to be willing to let this man rule over him. The only problem was the will. It wasn't that it was intellectually unacceptable. It wasn't that he wasn't emotionally prepared. He just was not willing to let Christ rule over him. Now, can a man be saved without going through all three of these? Well, I think that a man can enter through any one of these. But if the other two do not come very soon, probably life did not take place. And we shoot for all three. Maybe a good illustration is getting married. You run into a girl, you see her, and she's beautiful. And you respond emotionally to her. And you think, boy, I'd sure like to be married to her. But then you begin to think, well, I wonder if she's a good homemaker. I wonder if she has this quality and if she has that quality. And you begin to use your reason a little bit. But then what it boils down to is, boy, am I willing to assume the responsibility for a wife and children and a house and give up my 2-foot lockers in a sack instead, have to haul my things around in a trailer? Am I willing to submit myself to that, the financial responsibility and so on? And that's kind of the way it is in our responding to Christ. Boy, I'd like to be a Christian. Well, yeah, but is it really true? Does it really work? Does it make sense? Well, am I willing to live my life in submission to Him? That's the real question. And let's make sure that when we present Christ to people, that they're faced with that question somewhere along the line. Well, how do we do this? How do we carry on this kind of a ministry? Maybe I can just kind of give you the pattern. And then I'll give you an example. We use something which we call an open study quite a bit. And the purpose of this open study is simply to open the subject with the natural contacts of the men that we have around us. The objective of these open studies is not to get people to make decisions. It is not even to present the gospel to them. The objective is to get them to worry. And usually what we do is about 15 of the fellows will get together, and each one will invite one or two fellows. And we usually have these on Sunday mornings, Sunday afternoons, Saturday nights, or something like that, when there's not much conflict in schedule. And they invite the fellows that they have been trying to reach with the gospel. Maybe they have talked to them about Christ a little bit. At least the other fellow knows that this young disciple is a Christian, and the subject has been broached. And so he'll go to him and invite him to come along. And it's funny, the atmosphere there is such that we have people asking, well, now when are you going to let us in? Let us know as soon as there's an opportunity for us to attend. And we have enough of those kind of people just kind of waiting in the wings so that when we have an open study, it doesn't take much work now to get them to come. At first, it was pulling teeth. But then, someone will prepare a presentation, like who was Jesus Christ, the credibility of the resurrection, the human problem, and sometimes it'll be, what is the message? Or it will be maybe an exposition on a passage like Isaiah 53, or something of that nature. I never speak at those, nor does Ken. Nor do I participate in the discussion. So, about 30 men show up. Now, to get them there, the fellows go and pick them up. Okay, we're going to have this study. We'd like to have you come. Sure, great. I'll be there. What time does it start? Well, it starts at 9:30. I'll be by to pick you up at 9:10. And so, we don't allow much chance for fallout. Of course, you fellows know all that. So, we meet for the study. The presentation is made, and we kick it open for discussion. Discussion will last maybe an hour and a half. And at first, our fellows would... someone would throw out a question or an observation that was pretty much on a philosophical level, and our fellows would answer it in the same way, using reason and philosophy and so on. But they've learned that that just doesn't strike fire. And the thing we tried to teach them is that if you're going to open your mouth, use the Bible. And defend everything with the Bible. Answer everything with the Bible. And that's a good thing for a young disciple to get into a system, isn't it? Well, there are a few times, a lot of times, where questions just don't get answered the way they should. But that's all right. You learn that way, you know. And we don't step in to save the situation, because then they'll get used to that. Well, as I said, the purpose of these studies is not to evangelize, but to get people to worry. And after two or three of these studies, just about all of the fellows show a real interest in going further. And the person who does the inviting then will offer to help the other get started in an investigation of the subject. Well, great. I'd like to do that. All right, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll get together next Tuesday, and I'll show you where to read. You know, the Bible's a big, big book with blue covers, and there's a couple thousand pages in it, and boy, it's pretty tough to know where to read, isn't it? So I'll show you where to read and how to make sense out of it. And so the fellows will get together, and they'll start out in the book of John. And he'll explain, they'll go in through probably the first chapter in the book of John, and then the Christian will say, okay, now you got the start. You just kind of read this next week, and then next week, and then you keep a piece of paper in your Bible. And anything you don't understand, you write it down. Anything you want to discuss with me, write it down. And we'll get together and talk about it. And so the next week they get together, they go through John chapter 2. And then John chapter 3, and John chapter 4, and keep on going. Now, it doesn't really matter what a person's position is on the Bible. He doesn't have to believe the Bible to be willing to investigate it. And our job is not to defend the Bible. Our job is simply to use it. Well, then, over a period of time, a person will come to see that this is what I need. And he makes a commitment. Now, let me give you an illustration. The last person that I worked with in this way was a fellow by the name of, I'll call him Abraham. His real name is Abraham. That's why I'll call him Abraham. He was a communist. And he used to come in. He lived in a pension, which is sort of a student boarding house, with one of our other fellows, Walter Yark. And he would come into Walter's room to heckle him. And that seemed to be his favorite pastime. And he was just a pain in the neck. And he'd come in and spend maybe an hour harassing Walter Yark with great regularity. And finally, in desperation, Yark says, well, why don't you come to one of our open studies? Well, that was probably what Abraham was trying to get a hold of. He's trying to get an invitation. because he came with the purpose, with the intent of dismounting our open studies. And he almost succeeded. What he would do was this. The fellow would make the presentation, maybe 20, 30 minutes. And then the discussion would go on for about 20 minutes. And then he'd say, there's a voice way down here, and he'd say, well, now, wait a minute. And then he'd throw out a very well-prepared question. And someone would open his mouth and get about a half a sentence out. Then Abraham would come in again with question two. And then, before anyone could open their mouth, and he'd say, and furthermore, and then question three, question four, question five. And then the gang would be sitting there working their jaws with nothing coming out, trying to figure out what question to answer. And after a few minutes of that, he'd fold his arms and sit back and say, see there, you fellows don't know what you're talking about. You can't answer my questions. Well, he was a very faithful man. He showed up at every one of our open studies. And I seriously considered the possibility of inviting him not to come back. But I thought, well, maybe we'll go one better. I'll invite him to study the scriptures with me, alone. Now, it's a very interesting thing. A man must maintain his image. And when he's with a crowd, or even with another person, he must be true to that image. And I found that many times the hard guy is true to that role, even in a small cell. But you get him alone, and he's a little boy. So I invited Abraham to begin to study the scriptures with me. And the way I did it was this. I went up to him after one of the studies, and I said, Abraham, what odds will you give me? He said, what do you mean? I said, will you give me 50% odds? What do you mean? Well, will you give me 50% odds and I'm right and you're wrong? And he says, no. Well, give me 20%. He says, no. He says, there's not a chance that God exists. And I says, well, come on, Abraham. Don't tell me that you have examined all known knowledge and all unknown knowledge and can assure me beyond a shadow of a doubt that God does not exist. Well, no, I wouldn't say that. So I said, well, okay, so give me 2%. Yeah, I'll give you 2%. And I said, well, Abraham, you mean to tell me that you will gamble on your eternal destiny on those kind of odds, 2%? Well, yeah, that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. Have you ever really investigated this subject? Well, kind of hem-hawed around. And I says, now, I don't mean, have you picked up some stuff from secondary sources? Everybody does that. You know, like books that people have written about the gospel, or clergymen, or anything like that. Now, those are secondary sources. Now, have you ever investigated the primary source? Well, what's that? Well, it's the Bible. Oh, yeah, well, I don't believe the Bible. Well, that's all the better. Because if you can disprove the Bible, you're off the hook. It's the only primary source we have. And so all I'm asking you is to check out the primary source, and if you can disprove that, or come to the conclusion that Jesus was not who he said he was, you're free. You're off the hook. Well, he bought it. And we began to meet to study the scriptures. And later he told me that, he said, you know, Jim, when we began to study the scriptures together, I purposed in my heart that I would not let you influence me. Now, that's a pretty good start. A guy deciding not to let you influence him, not believing a thing, having an entirely different philosophy. And so off we went. We got into the book of John. We started out. And we'd read a little bit, and I'd ask him questions, trying to get him to think through on what it meant. And so finally we'd come up with the meaning of the passage, and then he'd say, yeah, but I don't agree with that. Well, I'd say, well, Abraham, I didn't ask you to agree with it. I'm just trying to help you understand what's written. Do you understand what's written here? Well, yeah. Well, what does it say? Well, it says this and that. Well, that's right, Abraham. Let's go on. Yeah, but I don't agree with it. I didn't ask you to agree with it. Let's go on. So we'd go on, and we'd read the next part, and he'd say, well, this is obviously a myth. The disciples wrote this down just to perpetrate a concept of Jesus. Well, okay, but what's the myth all about? Well, it says this and that. Okay, do you understand it? Well, yeah, I don't agree with it. Well, that's okay. Let's go on. We understand. I'm after. All I want you to do is understand it. Well, then we went on. And he'd say, well, John's obviously exaggerating here. This just could not be true. Well, yeah, but look at look at chapter 1. At least it's consistent, isn't it? Well, yeah, it's consistent, but I don't agree with it. Yeah, but okay, let's go on. So, we went that way, you know, kind of tooth and nail, dog and cat, for about the first 3.5-4 chapters of John. Well, then all of a sudden he fell silent. And there was a monologue going on every time we'd meet. And all he would do is he'd sit there on his neck, writing, making a few notes and drawing pictures. And I didn't know whether I was getting through or not. Well, we went on through chapter 4, chapter 5, chapter 6, chapter 7, that way. And pretty soon he emerged and began to talk again. But you know that he was on my side when we began to talk. And there were no more tirades. And he would make positive contributions. He'd say, well, yeah, that means that. That makes sense. Well, I didn't say anything. Just kept studying with him. And I noticed a change in his life. The Brazilian government has put up what they call the Project Rondon, which is a project that they have set up for university students to keep them from rioting during the summer. What they do is they go into the underdeveloped areas, and the doctors will dock, and the dentist will pull teeth, and the agronomist, which he happens to be, will help people plant gardens, and so on like that. Well, he went on one of those. I can hardly believe it. Because up to that time, he was dedicated only to destruction. You know, tear down the establishment and out with the status quo and all that kind of thing. Well, then he came back, and you know what he did? He organized another project, Rondon. And then he organized an excursion for his class. All the time studying John, the two of us. One time he said, you know, Jim, he says, I have to make a commitment to something in my life. He said, either it'll be politics, and you know what he meant by that, or it will be Christ. Now, whatever I commit myself to, I must give it everything I have. I said, well, Abraham, that's pretty good thinking. Let's go on. Well, it wasn't long until the change became so evident that I just couldn't stand it. And you know what the change consisted of? He loved. He loved me. He loved people around him. You know, that's what the Bible says that happens to people when they come to Christ. And so, one time I said to him, well, Abraham, something has happened to you, hasn't it? He said, yep. Certo. And I said, tell me about it. And he went on to tell me how he had committed himself to Christ. And he said, well, I just couldn't, you know, it's true. I give up. But he said, I still have some doubts. That's fine. So did the apostles in Matthew 28. But he said, there's one thing you should know, Jim. He says, it's this. And notice the language. He said, I feel very strongly about the injustices against the masses, particularly the people in the rural areas who are being exploited by the capitalists. And he said, for this reason, I'm very active in politics, and I am against the current government, which also means that I'm anti-American. Now, my friends think that I'm being inconsistent for studying with you, but I tell them that this has nothing to do with it because you're a Brazilian born in the States. I used to think, he said, that communism was the answer to this country, but he said, I don't think so anymore. And then he stopped. I said, well, go on. He said, well, that's it. Well, what'd you tell me that for? Well, I just thought you should know. Well, do you think it makes any difference? Well, no. And I said, well, there's just one thing I want to say to you. And we turned to John 13:13. And we read, you call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. And I said, what did Jesus mean when he said, I'm your teacher? Well, he meant that your orientation has to come from him. Your concepts, your ideas, your ideology originates with him. And you check back to see if your concepts and your ideas correspond with what he wants you to think. So he is the one who tells you what to think and what to believe. Do you buy that? Yep. Well, then he said, I'm your Lord. In Portuguese, it comes across better, Senhor, which means senior officer. Now, this means that you take your commands from Jesus. He's the one who tells you what to do. You buy that? Yep. Well, that ended our discussion on politics. You know, we never discuss politics down there. Jim Downing pointed out that Jesus had on the same team Simon the Zealot and Levi. Now, what was Levi's job? Matthew's job. Well, he was a tax collector. How did he do it? Well, he'd stand beside a Roman official, and as the people from his hometown would come by, he'd say, that guy's in rags, but he's loaded. And so what he was a traitor to the people in his own hometown. Now, Simon the Zealot was a hot-headed nationalist wanting to overthrow the Roman government. Now, how do you suppose Jesus kept those two from killing each other? Well, he called them something higher. I'm sure the subject never came up. And the subject never comes up among the fellows there in Brazil. Another one of the fellows who will be leading the work next year is a dentist now. He was the head of a communist cell group. Communists make good Christians. Well, about this time, this is about the time that Ho Chi Minh died. And I remember reading in Time magazine the report, or sort of a vignette of his life. And it stated that in 1927, Ho Chi Minh was in Paris looking for support from the Western world for his ideas for Vietnam. But he didn't find any. And I remember thinking at the time, what if someone had led Ho Chi Minh to Christ there in Paris back in 1927? That would have changed history, wouldn't it? Well, Abraham is that kind of a guy. He's brilliant. He could be president of Brazil someday. And I think he even has his eye on it. Whether he's a communist or whether he's a Christian doesn't make a whole lot of difference as far as his getting there is concerned. But it could change history. And I think that that's significant. I make this point to show you that the gospel can reach any man. So often we go to the guys who look like they'd make good Christians anyway. The easy guys. Because we don't know how to get to the hard guys. Another thing that I have learned is that in presenting the gospel in this way, over a period of time and as a process, that the fatality rate is almost zero. I've had 5 casualties in Brazil. People that I've gotten decisions from who have not gone on. I have led 5 people to make decisions after 1 or 2 conversations with them about the gospel. Guess who those 5 casualties were? I think there's a correlation. And I tried to answer for myself, why is it that a man, when he is presented with the gospel in this way, sticks? And why is it that you give a presentation of the gospel, maybe you have a 50% fallout or something like that? What's the difference? And I'm not sure that I have the answer, but I have some speculations. One is that I believe that there's a difference between presenting the plan and presenting the man. Now, you can present the plan of salvation to somebody, and he can get saved. But you present the man, the person of Christ, and the man falls in love. And that's what happens. As we go through the scriptures, the personality of Jesus Christ comes out. And the man cannot resist that personality as it's encountered in the scriptures. And he responds to the man and not just a plan. Another thing that I've observed, that favors the kind of evangelism that we're doing, is that it produces in the new Christian a submission to the Bible, which is really astonishing. We do not defend the authority of the Scriptures, we assume it. And the Scriptures assume authority over this person as he responds to the gospel. And so that relationship with the Scriptures continues immediately after spiritual birth. We had one fellow who came to Christ. His life was messed up. He was living with a woman who was not his wife, and it was kind of a knotty problem, because in Brazil there's no divorce. If it had been here in the United States, she would have been divorced, they would have been married, and it would have been a different story. She had a child living in another town. Well, when I met this fellow, she happened to be in the other town staying with her child for a while. And she stayed away long enough for him to come to Christ. Well, then he said, well, what do I do with this problem? Well, I didn't know what to say to him, because I realized that there was a cultural difference here. He was not promiscuous with a number of women and things. It was just a good, healthy, illegal relationship. So, and it was a hang-up for him in coming to Christ. And I explained to him, well, you're not going to resolve the problem all by yourself. One thing I do know is that you need the assistance of Jesus Christ. Now, he's not going to change the situation the day you commit yourself to him, but he will work it out. Well, some time went by. As a matter of fact, a few months went by, and the situation was not resolved. And she would come and visit him, and I would see him shove off, and it would just tear me to pieces. And it would tear him to pieces. And one day he came to me and he said, Jim, what do I do? Well, I was in a hurry. And thank God I was in a hurry, because all I had time to do was jot down about 6 scriptures on the subject and give it to him. I was getting ready to take a trip, and I was catching a plane. And I said, well, here, take these scriptures and study them, and when we get back, we'll talk about it. Well, on my trip, I consulted with a number of pastors and missionaries, and the consensus of their council was, tell them to stay with her. And I was trying to figure out from those scriptures how I could kind of twist them around to have them say that. So when I came back, I saw the guy every day. He didn't bring the subject up, and it was kind of a delicate subject, and I didn't want to bring it up, and so I just kind of waited. I waited 6 weeks, and the subject never came up. And finally I said, hey, how'd you come out on those... How did you come out on those scriptures? What scriptures? Well, those scriptures that I gave you before I took the... Oh, that, he said. Yeah, that. Well, it's obvious from scriptures that it wouldn't work, so I just cut it off. Well, that would not have happened if he did not have a right relationship with the scriptures to start with. Where did he get that? Because the scriptures had already messed in his life so much that he was used to that. Well, then another observation that I've made about the kind of evangelism that we're talking about is that the man is easily discipled because of the bond of love and friendship that is established between you in the process of evangelism. Now, it had always been my experience previously that here I'd have a friend, and then I'd present the gospel to him, and I'd be scared stiff. Why? Because I was putting the friendship on the line, and sometimes I lost the friend. But you know, it's interesting, but the opposite takes place when we get together to examine the Scriptures, as we do. Instead of my coming to him and, you know, the gospel is offensive. You come up and you poke a guy in the chest and you say, you are a sinner and you have this problem and that problem and this problem, and it's an accusation. Now, you can't get away from that because that is what the gospel is. But before, I was sort of the accuser. Now, the Holy Spirit and the Word of God are the accusers. And I'm his friend, kind of patting him on the back and say, well, look, we'll find a way out of this. And we get together and study the Scriptures, and he encounters these things, and they jolt him. But instead of being the accuser, I comfort him and say, well, yeah, but God is drawing you to himself. And so the bond, the relationship is there in such a way that it is never delicate afterwards. I never have to hunt him down and try to draw him around and get him to tie in, because the comradeship is already there. Well, those are three reasons why I think it's important to take your time and bring your person to Christ and not pushing for a decision. Let me repeat them. One is that it produces a low casualty rate. Two, a man has a right relationship with the Scriptures the day he's born. And three, it enhances your relationship with the individual for the purpose of discipling. And you know, man, this has done something for myself, for me, this experience. I never had a problem with the inspiration of the Scriptures. Well, I haven't had one for a long time. There was a time when I did. But you know, there was a time when I would stoutly defend the inspiration of the Scriptures. But at the same time, I didn't trust them very much. I was more confident in some cute sayings and some quotations from Pascal and a few others than I was in the Scriptures. But when a communist who doesn't want to be influenced only can last 12 chapters in the book of John, you know that it's good stuff. And then I know that if I can put a man next to the Scriptures and keep him there, he is going to get saved. Aldo Bent, who is I told you about him, he's a theologian, really. And his colleagues just don't believe the Bible. As a matter of fact, when I met him, he didn't believe the Bible. And he said, now how do I explain my position on the Bible to them? How can I make a statement about the inspiration of the Scriptures to them without turning them off right off the bat? Well, as he asked me this question, it occurred to me that I hadn't even thought about this question for the past 5 years, the inspiration of the Scriptures. And I came up with a new answer for it, and it's this. I said, well, Aldo, I couldn't expect your colleagues to buy my concept of inspiration of the Scriptures. I wouldn't even ask them to sign my doctrinal statement, because they haven't had the same experiences with the Scriptures that I have. And I would recommend that if your colleagues have problems with the inspiration of the Scriptures, put them to the test and use them the way we do for a while, and then let them decide what the Scriptures are. And they will see that the Bible is inspired and is authority, and they will not have any questions. So, men, we have the goods. We've got the Bible. And we have the Holy Spirit, and our job is to put the non-Christian in contact with those two forces. And that's what evangelism is, I think. Okay? Well, not much time left. I have one other thing to say before we take a few minutes for some questions, and that is that in a moment of weakness, I offered to write down the questions that we have been using over the past few years in Brazil in this kind of evangelism. And so we have written out the whole thing, all 21 chapters. It involves 23 studies. We call it 24 Hours with John because someplace in there we work in the bridge. And you know, that's a good invitation itself. How would you like to spend 24 hours with one of the original Christians? Well, that's not a bad idea. You know, get straight scoop. So 24 hours with John. And the fellows here have mimeographed them or copied them somehow, or I haven't even seen them. And we'll make those available to you. Now, let me give you one suggestion. This is just a personal opinion. But I do not like to meet with a non-Christian and have a booklet in my hand, a Bible study booklet of any kind. You know why? He'll think, I wonder what he's trying to indoctrinate me in. And I would suggest that if you use these Bible studies, don't have them there with you in front of you. Write the questions in the margin of your Bible to put them in your head or something. And just show up with the Bible. And I'm not saying that these are the only questions that you will be able to use, but I hope that they will stimulate you to come up with your own questions. And they will just serve as a springboard to this kind of an approach with the gospel.